Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining James Corbett of the Corbett Report for the second and third segment of the program today. And today is Thursday, December 10th, 2015. I got that part right. It is Thursday, December 10th, 2015. Once again, thank you for listening to the program today. And let's get started right away. I have a lot to talk about here in the first 20 minutes. We have gold today, struggled most of the day, and I think we're going to see that here until, Mrs. Janet Yellen makes her decision next week, which the decision has already been made, but until we're told of that, we have gold down about 90 cents today in the New York spot price after market trading at 1,072.60. Yes, silver down 5 cents today at 14.19. Platinum is down $2 at 858, along with palladium down 11 at 543. If the USDX today was stronger, 0.58 at 97.94. Pressure on crude oil once again down 0.66 at 36.50 for crude oil today. And of course, the paper markets, let's get to that screen. The paper markets, the Dow was up about 82 points today at 17,575. The NASDAQ was up 22, 5,045. And the S&P was up 4, 2,052. Oh, the 10-year yield, 2.24%, up 0.03, and we have the euro. Of course, we saw the pressure on the euro with the strength in the dollar, 0.68 at 109. Foreign markets, Asia, Japan was down 1.3%. Everything else was fairly flat with very little change in the European and Hong Kong markets. And, you know, we talk about markets. There's a few things going on in the economy and so forth. Of course, everything is focused on Donald Trump. Everything is focused on the Muslims, and everything is focused on terrorism. And so we're going to focus a little bit on the economy. And if I have time, I've got some stats for you regarding the number of Muslims in this country and where we're going to be in 2050. And really, 2050 is not that far away. So this isn't big news, and if you listen to this program, you already know the conditions of the world. But hey, the UN today came out and they made this stunning headline that the world economy stumbled 2015. Of course, that isn't any great shock to anyone, as I mentioned, who listens to this program. Growth estimated at just 2.4% this year, following a nearly 60% drop in oil prices and an over 20% fall in commodity prices in the last 18 months. This report was released today. The World Economic Situation and Prospects for 2016 said that certainly all the developing and some of the Soviet bloc countries suffered a broad slowdown since the financial crisis of 2008. We see unemployment on the rise. Again, nothing shocking. What I found interesting about their report, though, is the investment in these developed countries is declining. All but five of the 20 largest developing countries observed a decline in investment over the last 18 months. So I found that a little bit of interesting, and I also found, and of course, when you have that type of drop and that type of little interest in funds, you're going to, and with the energy, you're going to have carbon emissions. That was also dropped. There was no growth, and it was only the second time that this has happened in the past 20 years, and I think the global warmers in Paris will like that. But anyway, this was the first time since 2009 that the global economy actually contracted. What was interesting, though, is they still expect oil to rise. They think after this excess supply dissipates a little bit that you can see this oil to go back to $63 by 2017. And so that's still a year away, but and I think next year will be a very interesting year. The Labor Department, our Labor Department, said that weekly applications for jobless aid rose 13,000. It's hard to believe it would rise at a time when we're in the middle of the Christmas season and you have many part-time jobs that are being hired in supposedly a lot of these brick-and-mortar stores to help the customer buy their Christmas gifts. But so there's a little bit interesting there. We certainly have had great weather across this country. I know on the East Coast it's been very warm, so you can't apply that to construction jobs being lost due to a unseasonably cold December. So again, just another sign of the times that things are not as what they want us to believe that they are. I guess here's some good news. You have the Nevada governor. They're unveiling a tentative $335 million agreement to attract an electric car maker's plant. The governor of Nevada. Oh, I see. It's a Chinese-backed electric car maker. It's a $1 billion plant to a Las Vegas suburb. So they did reveal a tentative agreement. The governor, Brian Sandoval, made the announcement today at a press conference. Nevada had topped Georgia, Louisiana, and California in competing for the factory. And the state is going to have to meet in special session. Yes, let's meet in special session for a Chinese company to approve the deal, which involves $335 million in tax incentives and infrastructure improvements in North Las Vegas. Now, you know, supposedly it's going to create and employ about 4,500 people at the plant when it reaches maturity in 2023. You know, I'm sure the people that will be working at this plant, you know, they need jobs, so it's good for their community. However, the way I look at it is here you have $335 million in tax incentives. Somebody has to pay for it. And so, again, it's just a little bit of, to me, as far as I see it, is robbing Peter to pay Paul. And you know, in the building of the plant, you also have a creation of a construction job. So it will be good for that community, North Las Vegas. And, you know, they did have their hard days in the, for waitresses and for the service industry in Las Vegas during all those casinos and everything that they have laid off. So good news for that area. The possible tax deal in Congress could mean big political wins for Obama, the Democrats, and the GOP. And, of course, we all know they're there searching for a compromise today on huge tax and spending bills with a combined price tag of well over $1 trillion. Everyone is hoping to clinch some sort of an agreement. You got it. Before they adjourn next week for the year. I mean, you can't have anything to hold up these politicians and keep them in Washington. You know, they have to get home for the holidays, and you have to make sure that Obama has a clear plate for any executive orders that he might do while everyone is on holiday. I mean, we know he has a big axe to grind with gun control, and certainly I expect something to be coming prior to the end of the year when everyone is gone so no one can resist and they can quietly slip something through while everyone has gingerbreads dancing in their heads. But certainly they're putting together a plan for much more detailed background checks, and hopefully we can get to talk about that today or maybe tomorrow when Al is back on the program. So they're looking to do that. Again, as I mentioned, the spending side are seeking a deal on a $1.1 trillion measure financing federal agencies for 2016. And I'm sure they will get something done. They did approve a short-term spending bill that will last until Wednesday. And that is expected to pass tomorrow, Friday. So negotiators were also hoping to strike a deal on a separate revenue bill that would cost $700 billion or more over 10 years. And, of course, that will always be more over 10 years by extending dozens of mostly obscure tax credits. You know, essentially, there's about 50 tax credits for individuals and businesses that expire every single year. And Congress goes through a once a year ritual of renewing them. And it's just such a waste of time. The federal budget deficit widened in November, driven by higher spending in areas such as Social Security, Medicare, defense. The November deficit climbed to $64.6 billion, up 13.6% from a year ago. And that's not going to stop. So I just cannot understand how these people who cry deflation for a longer term period, when you continue to have government that will continue to grow and spend. Yeah. Forget that the stimulus hasn't created any type of inflation that they were requesting or needed. But everything else is so manipulated and controlled. I mean, why would certain things be any different? And so to me, when people predict these major extremes, when they predict these extremes in the markets and they know from some source that this is going to happen and that is going to happen, how can you follow anything when everything is so manipulated and nothing is as was? How can you compare today with the Depression? It's like comparing apples and oranges. Certainly, we can look at the warning signs coming into the Depression. We can look at the warning signs prior to the stock market crashes. Certainly, we can look at the comparison with Homestake as their shares soared after they confiscated gold. And we went into the Depression. That soared, that stock. Of course, you have to compare it that way. You can't. So it's very difficult to compare apples and oranges to what is happening today because we're in an area that has never happened before. So you can draw some comparisons, but I think these folks are really, really wrong. And that's why we're different. We're different. And I know I should stick to the economy, gold and silver. This is where my expertise lies. 21 years of following the market You know, I make logical predictions by finding and analyzing the truth. And I am more right than wrong. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the economy, just give you the stats that I did, but I also wanted to talk about what is on everyone's mind, and that is what is being touted across the newscast in the country 24/7, and I won't get to do all of it in the 5 minutes that I have left. And I think what you're really seeing, in my view, my opinion, an observation of maybe, is I think what we're really looking at and seeing is maybe a final transformation of this country. And just like anything else, as it changes, you're going to see resistance. And I think when you look at the tools that the elite have to complete their agenda, you know, I'm not so sure how this is all going to play out. I think the resistance really does not know why or what they are standing up to. The natives are restless. And they have reason to be. Our country is trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. Our infrastructure is failing. We have a country that is run by a corrupt government with, and you look at all the agencies, all the additional ineffective agencies, where it hurts the American people more than helps them. Now we have this immigration problem. It's not a new problem. It's been here a very long time. We've had these same problems, but they've just been, you know, brushed underneath a rug. But the immigration problem is what is currently in the forefront and getting people's attention. Donald Trump, with his comment, he has captured the world's attention. And it's like, here's a guy that's not even in office. And anything he says is just his opinion. But yet it has governments around the world. You have England looking to try and ban him from coming to England. You have states and cities. They're trying to keep Donald Trump out of their areas. It's ridiculous, it's insane, and yet the media has globbed onto this and is certainly getting the attention on both sides. And we certainly do have an aging population. By 2015, Islam will become the second largest religious group in the United States. 2050 is not a long time away. I saw an interview by a reporter, I think she was from the Daily Mail of the UK, and it was the same thing that I saw when I was in England. She says, the citizens here, we don't like the immigration. We don't want the immigration of Muslims, but it has been touted as a good thing that government is out there saying what a great thing multiculturalism is. You have Angela Merkel, who just got Times Person of the Year. Why did she get Person of the Year? Well, she got it because of her hard line and open mind on migration. And they say that's her biggest achievement this year. You have European nations that are scrambling to accommodate these refugees from the Middle East. And Merkel insists on opening Germany to an expected 1 million asylum seekers. But you also have to look to see who was second on Time's Person of the Year. And that was the leader of ISIS. And of course, I get that the Person of the Year is not, it's not a popularity contest. But really, a terrorist group that has escalated into a global threat, and it doesn't matter who backs this group. But again, it's just how many people understand why they choose these people, and there'll be a lot of the, you know, mainstream population out there, the general population, that will think, "Wow, she must be a good leader. She was elected Times Person of the Year. But anyway, there's some interesting stats here on the Muslims. And, of course, I'll make sure I save this for tomorrow because I'm not going to get to it. Muslims make up approximately 0.9% of the U.S. adult population, or 1.8 million Muslim adults. If children are included, the Muslim population in the United States totals 2.75 million Muslims in this country, and the majority of whom, 63%, are immigrants. This is the fastest growing religion in America, and by 2050, it is projected to more than double. Those identifying with Islam are projected to comprise 2.1% of the U.S. population. Among all immigrants to the United States, the Muslim share also doubled in just 10 years, from roughly 5% in 1992 to 10% of all immigrants in 2012. And in that year, 2012, 100,000 Muslim immigrants entered the country. And I guess I am out of time. 20 minutes goes by fast. I'll be back tomorrow with Alfred Addis. For now, enjoy the 20 minutes or the 2 segments with Alfred and James Corbin.
Job stress, financial obligations, or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll-free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now. American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hello, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. He's calling in from Japan, where he's been since, I don't know, 11 years now, 14, I don't recall clearly, James, but you've been over there for over a decade.
11 years,
okay. And one of the things that surprises me is today I was looking at video, you know, YouTube videos, and I found one that it said, Google Hillary Clinton rape.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
And much to my surprise, I recognized your voice as soon as I turned on that video. And what I'm getting to, you talk about economics and talk about politics and geopolitics and a lot of things, but you seem to be becoming something like a one-man media outlet. You've even got something to say about Hillary Clinton rape. I keep stumbling into...
I'm following you around.
Well, I don't know. Whatever's happening, apparently you've made either that or you've affected my browser where it will only go to articles that are written or spoken by James Corbett. But you are really getting around. I wonder, do you think that's something you'll be able to sustain?
I certainly hope so. I mean, that's the whole point of the website. The website wasn't created for any one particular purpose. It was really more to be an outlet for my various interests and things that I think are important. So there's really no limit to what I theoretically could cover. It's more along the lines of what I'm interested in.
If there are any limits, they're self-imposed.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so you can talk about anything you want to talk to, but you've got a pretty broad spectrum. Goes a lot. For example, again, this Google Hillary Clinton rape. The idea is that Hillary Clinton at one point has, if I understand correctly, the idea is that Hillary Clinton has, talking to rape victims, said that you have the right to be heard, you have the right to be believed, all right, when you make your complaints about rape. And you come back and you tell us that this is a rejection of thousands of years of Western jurisprudence. Can you tell us how you reach that conclusion?
Well, this is one of the sort of trendy political ideas that have taken off on the left in recent years, is that, well, you just have to believe. I mean, people have the right to be believed. I'm not even sure I know exactly what that means, but if that is meant in a legal sense, that accusers have the right to be believed, then the obverse of that is that those who are accused are automatically presumed to be guilty, which of course is the exact reverse of what Western jurisprudence, as I say in the video, has been built on, which is the presumption of innocence until you are proven guilty. That doesn't mean that, you know, you are innocent until you're proven guilty. It just means that in the eyes of the law, you are presumed to be innocent until a court of law can prove you to, or to beyond a reasonable doubt, to be guilty. And that's a pretty good way of structuring a judicial system, I think, because obviously the onus should be on the accuser to prove that someone is accused before you throw them in a cage or do whatever you're going to do with them. So I find that to be a worrying trend amongst certain sectors of the left, that now we are expected to simply believe accusers on their say-so. And we've seen actually some outlets falling into some problems with that recently. People might remember the Rolling Stone debacle where they ran an article about rape on campus. I can't remember which campus it was, but some campus in the United States, talking about this idea of rape culture on college campuses in the U.S. And they had this specific example about this fraternity that supposedly had engaged in this group rape of this woman who was featured in this article. But under the slightest bit of scrutiny from the outside, the case started to fall apart, and it turned out that party that she had allegedly been at didn't even happen that night, and there were all sorts of problems with the story, and Rolling Stone eventually had to retract it and say, oh, you know, we made a big, huge mistake here. But we thought it would be imprudent to question what this woman had told us, which, I mean, again, for journalistic standard, that's just beyond imagination, that you could just simply believe someone, what someone says, instead of doing basic reporting to find out if it's true or not before running it in your national publication. Mm-hmm. So again, there's some pretty big problems coming up with that. But the point of that video was to highlight the hypocrisy of what Hillary is at least professing to believe with regards to that versus what is in the actual record of, for example, Bill Clinton's rape accusers.
And that was one of the, you had an excerpt in there where someone stood up and asked Hillary while she was on the stage if the rapes that deserved to be believed included the ones that were charged against Bill Clinton.
Exactly.
So Hillary
right.
Clinton came back and said, well, they should be believed until it's proven that the rapes didn't take place.
Yeah,
but again,
exactly.
Complete violation of the idea of innocent until proven guilty.
Yes.
Is there anything that can be done? Is this? Are we going to see more rape in the future or less? Or is it just going to be the way it has? Really, is it? Maybe it's at the level that it's always been. Do you think rape is becoming more common, less common? Where do
That's
you think
a very
going?
Difficult question to answer. I would imagine there are so many variables that play into something like that. Mm-hmm. I think our understanding of what rape is changing. And I think there are some good things out of that. I mean, I think rape is not just men in back alleys holding knives to women's throats kind of thing, that image of rape. I mean, there are a lot of different ways that non-consensual sex happen. And I think it's good to expand our understanding of that. But at the same time, I mean, is it increasing? Is it decreasing? How does that factor into? I mean, there are economic factors that play into things like that. I mean, as criminality goes up, as economic factors, as the economy goes down and things of that nature, we're starting to see, for the first time in a long time, we're starting to see a re-rise in the rates of violent crime in the United States and elsewhere, where it has been on the decline for a very long time. We're starting to see it go back up in a lot of urban centers. So that is a worrying phenomenon, and I think that is related to economic breakdown, but it's also a societal breakdown. And I think one of the most worrying factors of the idea of some sort of economic collapse or at least economic slowdown at this point is that if you think back to the 1930s and the way the Great Depression played out in the United States, it played out in a way that it could have been a lot worse, but there was still a lot of the community fabric, the societal fabric in place, that you had a largely rural population still at that time that was at least capable of some degree of self-sufficiency, and they certainly had to scrape by in a lot of places, but they managed to do so by sticking together. I think in a similar situation in our day and age, the way that society has been dislocated by the urbanization process and just the fact that everyone's dependent on the industrial food supply and things of that nature, I think it would play out very differently, and I think we would see a lot more criminality. And I think that is something that we should be concerned about when we think of the collapse scenarios.
Did you see the article by The Economist and or by The Washington Examiner, which discussed The Economist article, where the headline was, The Economist Speaks Out on U.S. Gun Control?
I did not see that, no.
Well, it's an interesting article because The Economist, reputed, you know, reputable publication, it says gun sales have doubled under President Obama, while the gun murder rate has been cut in half since 1993. Making America a much safer place. And that's according to The Economist. Over 16 million new guns entered the U.S. marketplace in 2013, up from about 7 million when Obama was elected. So we're buying twice as many guns per year right now as we did when Obama was elected. And one of them, The Economist says, Mr. Obama's presidency has stirred up anxiety among gun owners. America has become, but they go on, they say, America has become a much safer place over the past two decades. However, the public sentiment has yet to catch on to the fact. Does that surprise you?
No, I mean, it shouldn't surprise us that much, but it is interesting to think about because, of course, the focus these days is on the drastic rise in the rates of these mass shooting events. But just because mass shooting events are on the rise does not mean that shooting events overall are on the rise. And in fact,
I
imagine that there is a decline that's gone on. So it is, as always, it's a question of what the media focuses on and what way they present the context of the evidence. And it's interesting. It is interesting that The Economist would be pointing that out because
I
would say it's more towards the left side of the equation most of the time. At any rate, it comes from a European perspective, a British perspective anyway, and is
surprising.
Mostly a mouthpiece of the Rothschild family. So it is interesting that they would be pointing that out.
Yeah, I agree. And the implication is that the more guns you have, the less gun deaths you have. That's the implication.
In the United
fact,
States,
you're relying
I think
on data that goes back, I don't know, 20 years or more.
In the United States, I think that equation does hold. But one of the most interesting takes that I heard on the whole gun issue was from the writer of the name is going to escape me all of a sudden.
Not tonight, I
Simon
don't.
Simon Black of Sovereign
Simon Black, Sovereign Man.
He has a podcast, and his take on it surprised me. He pointed out some of the statistics from various countries that show in some countries, when gun ownership goes up, the gun crime rate goes down. In other countries, it's the exact opposite, and also when gun ownership goes down, sometimes the crime rate goes down, sometimes it goes up. It varies from country to country, and I think it is important that there is a cultural factor in it. And certainly in the United States, I think it is absolutely a part of the culture, and a part of what has made the United States what it is. That gun culture has created a situation where absolutely I think gun ownership does lead to a decline in gun crime because people are armed and people know how to use the guns and people are willing to use the guns. And I think that in that culture, absolutely gun ownership is important to keeping criminality down.
Do you understand what the reason was for the Second Amendment?
Well, obviously, tyrants. That's specifically
what it's
about.
What it was. And it says so in a document that's come to be called Preamble to the Bill of Rights. Anybody who's listening can look this up. And it says this was essentially the cover letter that they attached to the 13 or more amendments that were proposed to the Constitution in 1789. And they sent this out, sent copies to every one of the states, and they said, okay, do you want to ratify it? I think they had 13. I've heard other people say there were 17 proposals. The states collectively ratified 10 of them, and those 10 became our Bill of Rights. And the Congress says the conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. Who has powers under the Constitution? James, are you still
there? Was
that
a question? Yes.
That's the question. Who has powers? And people talk about the only people who have powers under the Constitution are the ones who are officers, officials, employees, bureaucrats. If you're working for the federal government, you in theory have powers under the Constitution. I don't have any powers under the Constitution.
Right.
I may have rights that are protected, but that's a completely different concept. The powers are granted by means of the Constitution, and they're telling us that the Bill of Rights was intended to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers.
Yeah.
Meaning the Constitution and particularly the Bill of Rights, and in this case the Second Amendment, was intended, push comes to shove, where you've got guns for the purpose of shooting government officials. And I don't think many people appreciate that. I don't think they understand that. You know, they think, the Second Amendment is to go duck hunting or deer hunting or whatever and blah, blah, blah. No, it's not. It's not even to protect us from an invasion by the English coming across the sea in boats or the Chinese coming across the Bering Strait. I think the founders understood, look, if you people are too dumb to defend yourself from an invasion, you might as well just fold it up and move to some other country because you're not worth anything. But
even within the Second Amendment itself, I mean, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Yep.
And I think the free state is an important part of that clause.
I agree.
Because obviously, how do you maintain freedom?
And of course,
anyone who reads the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, all of the things surrounding the debate around the Constitution, understand the context of that debate and the fact that it's not about simply protecting the country from outside invasion. It is absolutely about the threat of takeover of tyranny within the government itself.
That's exactly what they're talking about. And when they do talk about a free state, they expressly say a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The whole Bill of Rights, it says a convention of the number of the states. All right. They wanted to prevent misconstruction or abuse of the powers of the Constitution, therefore they did the first 10 amendments. Those first 10 amendments only apply within the states of the Union. Huh? They don't apply within the territories. They don't apply within Washington, D.C., at least not under the original Constitution. And there are people who believe that the government has created an artificial state that's territorial rather than a state of the union.
Right.
An administrative district. And if you're caught in that venue, then the government can control your right to keep and bear arms. On the other hand, if you can establish that you are within the venue of a state of the union, maybe you can avoid that. There are a lot of odds and ends. Where are we? I guess we're right next to taking a break. Why don't we do that right now? Let's take a break and we'll come back with more questions. I'm Alfred Addis. Here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett on financial survival. And we were talking about, when we closed down, we're talking about some people's belief that the government has set up a territory of Texas, for example, as opposed to the state of Texas, meaning a state of the union, and a territory for the state of Ohio, for Ohio, rather than the state of Ohio, which would be a member of the perpetual union styled the United States of America. Now, some people think that idea, if they grasp it at all, are going to say that idea is just stupid. All right? I've looked at it for over a decade, probably 15 years or more, and I am persuaded that it's probably roughly correct, but I could be wrong. So here's another one. Is this just a dumb idea? Is this hyperbole, or is this likely to be true? Mike Adams is the also known as the Health Ranger, is the editor and publisher for naturalnews.com. And he seems to be a credible sort. I've seen his information for a couple of years and the rest of that sort of thing. And his headline is, Obama is a sleeper cell for radical Islam. And he goes on, he says, how the destruction of America's culture, economy, and national security was planned from the start. As President Obama is about to make his televised speech this evening, several days ago, it's important that every American realize who he really is. Obama is a sleeper cell who's intent on the deliberate destruction of America's culture, economy, and national defense. When President Obama speaks, he's speaking not as an American, but as a radical communist Muslim pretending to be an American. Is that too radical to be believed, or do you think there may be some validity to that?
Well, I haven't listened to the podcast in question that this is apparently based around, so I can't comment on it in detail. It would be interesting to hear what kind of information he has to support that. But I think that gives it tends to give Obama, I think, too much credit. I mean, I think Obama is little more than a mouthpiece for the establishment forces that put him into power and could remove him from power at a moment's notice. So I tend to find that kind of rhetoric a bit overblown. But, I mean, I think generally speaking, the point that the establishment has put in place a system that is designed to actually bring down America rather than build it up is a valid point.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's another one of these goofy ideas that you look at and you don't want to believe, but you have to admit there's enough evidence to make you suspicious. What else did I have? I saw an article yesterday or the day before that described the recent election in Venezuela where the right wing overwhelmed the left wing in the legislature. And the Hugo Chavez coalition, based on Hugo Chavez and Resna, they were disabled, they were in shock, they couldn't believe they lost so badly, but they did. And the article went on to point out that this is similar to an indictment for someone at the top of the Brazilian government who was on the left, and they were being indicted and charged with a crime. And also, what was the third one?
There was a third Argentina. Country.
Yeah, Argentina.
Just got voted out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the point behind the article was that the right wing seems to be gaining a lot of traction in South America. And they wondered how many other nations in South America are going to follow. And I'm wondering, do you think the change from leftist toward rightist in South America, do you think that will influence what's going on here in this country, in America?
I think it does. I think the way and the reason that this is important is because the question of whether Latin America is leaning left or leaning right obviously has implications for the economies and the political spheres of that area, but it has geopolitical connotations as well, because for decades now, David Rockefeller and his political cronies have been supporting things like the Council of the Americas and other organizations like that to try to bring about the free trade area of the Americas and to really consolidate NAFTA into a North and South America type of union. First, of course, an economic free trade area, and then, of course, consolidating political power behind that. Mm-hmm. And the bulwark against that has been the leftist governments that have been in power in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Venezuela, in Cuba. And it is interesting to see Cuba being sort of absorbed into the U.S. sphere of influence now with opening up of relations. And Argentina, we have Kirchner going down to the center-right opposition. Venezuela, as you say, Chavez, of course, giving way to Maduro, who has now lost the parliamentary election there. And it looks like Evo Morales is one of the few sort of leftist roadblocks against that FTAA agenda in South America right now. So it is extremely interesting to watch this happen, and one can speculate as to whether there are greater machinations at work here, because certainly Chavez was a target of the United States quite openly with regards to the coup attempt. Back around, was that 2000, 2001, around that time frame? And ever since then, I think the crosshairs have been on a lot of these leaders. So it is interesting to watch this playing out right now, and it will be interesting to see if this does lead to a renewed push for some closer consolidation of economic ties between North and South America.
Well, I'm wondering if Donald Trump isn't a manifestation of the same spirit we're seeing down in South America. Is the Trump phenomena evidence that this country is moving from a leftist perspective back toward something that might be viewed as conservative? And if it is this a good thing? Did I understand you to say that the leftists were the people that were inhibiting our movement into the New World Order? North American Union, and the rightists are the ones who want to get us into that globalist?
Well, I wish it were that simple. I don't think it is. But in that context of the sort of the South America being absorbed into the NAFTA and into a greater political union, it was those leftist governments that were against that agenda. I don't think it was necessarily because they were angels who were trying to protect people from the New World Order. Certainly, I have no love for the Chavezes and the other, you know, would-be dictators, really, of South America, who, with whatever degree of popular support, did some pretty indefensible things of confiscating people's property and trying to make it part of their glorious socialist revolution. So I don't think it's good guy versus bad guy or anything quite that simplistic, but at least in that particular narrative of... And there's an excellent clip up online on YouTube. There's a clip of Dick Cheney speaking in front of the Council on Foreign Relations several years ago where he says, oh, I'm a member. I used to be a director of the CFR, but I didn't tell that to my constituents when I was campaigning for re-election back in Wyoming. And everybody laughs as if it's some kind of funny joke. But that clip, at the beginning of that clip, if you see the larger section of that, there's quite a detailed overview of the many, many organizations that David Rockefeller specifically had been involved with, either funding, establishing, or as a director or a board member of, that were all devoted to consolidating the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And it's quite an interesting list when you see the sort of bureaucratic monstrosity that could be created by just one man with an incredible amount of resources, obviously, as an example of how that political agenda is pushed forward. So to see that political agenda roadblocked is a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean the people who are acting as the roadblock are good people or acting from good intentions.
Well, it's just a surprise sometimes to suppose that maybe people that you think of as your adversaries, maybe they're doing, sometimes they're doing things that you would approve of. Now, that really isn't a surprise. You're bound to see it any place you go. It's bound to happen from time to time. But there's a question of how much, you know. Oh, surprise, surprise.
I think it's actually quite analogous to the idea that a lot of people have, that if NATO and the U.S. is kind of a power out of control, then the BRICS must be the answer to that. Well, certainly, yes, if Russia or China are acting as roadblocks in places like Syria, that can be a good thing. But it doesn't mean that they're angels acting from the best intentions for humanity. Maybe it just means they want their own sort of slice of the pie, and they're going to consolidate things in a different way.
It's the Bloods versus the Crips.
Unfortunately so,
Yep, that's the way it works out. I've got an article here from Gold Eagle. Is the Fed about to light the fuse on a $9 trillion debt bomb? And they make a few comments that are interesting. It says, the U.S. Federal Reserve and European Central Bank have created a very dangerous situation. Throughout the last 6 years, there's been a sense of confrontation between the Fed and the European Central Bank. This was evident both in terms of where the capital went as well as how it was delivered via monetary policy. For instance, when the Federal Reserve released its discount window documents in 2011, it became clear that most of the funds from quantitative easing too actually went to foreign banks located in the European Union. Similarly, when the European Union banking system was close to imploding in 2012, the Fed coordinated with the European Central Bank to announce QE3 in an effort to prop up the European banking system and calm overseas jitters to aid the Obama administration in its reelection campaign. In short, from 2008 to 2014, the Fed and European Central Bank worked together. Now, why is our Federal Reserve giving money, that might not be the accurate term, but that's what I think it amounts to European banks, and more than likely leaving the bill for the money that they've given to the federal banks or to the foreign banks, leaving that bill for the American people?
Well, I think to understand the Fed and its actions, we should keep in mind the Federal Reserve really is Wall Street, and Wall Street is the Fed. Whatever kind of dressing they put on it, it is ultimately the consolidation of the banking cartel, and as represented by the main banks on Wall Street. So when it does actions like this, we have to see it from that perspective. And I think there are potentially monetary interests for a lot of the major Wall Street investment banks for keeping Europe propped up during its time of crisis. And we can see that at a number of different levels. But, I mean, for example, Goldman Sachs' involvement in the Greek crisis and other sort of disasters like that, they have an interest in buying things up at pennies on the dollar when they collapse, but keeping them from that point of total collapse where they actually default on the debt. You want to keep these people strung along enough that they can continue to make their debt payments. So I think there may be some sort of financial interest in that regard. But I think that the real story when it comes to this debt, this rate hike that will they, won't they, next week, I think the real story is going to come from the emerging economies. And to put a figure on this, since the Lehman collapse in 2009 until mid-2014, there was $750 billion of capital outflows from the United States, mostly towards the emerging economies and markets there, as investors basically looked anywhere to try to get returns, and the best returns were coming from those markets. From July 2014 to September 2015, there was an inflow of $230 billion, and that is accelerating at this point. And will
inflow into the United States or into the
third world? That's right. It's coming back from the emerging economies back into the United States as investors start pulling out because rates are going to hike, so they're going to have to cover the debt that they've got out there, the funny money they're playing with. And that, if they do hike rates, obviously that will accelerate it even more. So we're likely to see, I mean, there's definitely been some downward trends in the emerging economy markets over the last few months and accelerating in the last few days, even as China is also, again, markets are going down in Asia, and that affects the emerging economies. And now with this rate hike, people are getting quite nervous. So I think really the immediate effect of this rate hike is going to be felt in the emerging economies. And unfortunately, again, with the globalist system that we have now, any destabilization anywhere in the world tends to feed back into other parts of the world. So now it's not just the United States that everyone in the world has to worry about. It's everyone in the world. Everyone else in the world can affect the United States as well. So I think the Fed understands this. This is one of the reasons that they at least alluded to last time when they didn't hike rates. And in the last meeting, they talked about the instability in emerging markets. And that was a talking point in the media, saying if the Fed hikes rates, it's going to cause a lot of damage elsewhere in the world. So I think they're aware of this system. And that's the immediate effect we're going to look at. And Europe will be affected by this as well. But I think the emerging economies much more so.
Then you're telling us that if the Federal Reserve raises the interest rate this next week, the first casualties, if we're going to see casualties, won't be in this country. They'll be in foreign countries. Is that roughly correct?
Yes, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've got one last question here to kind of close out. Ben Sasse, Republican, Nebraska, is in the Senate. He's first just elected there for the first time. It says, in deference to tradition, freshman senator waited a year before delivering his maiden speech so he could observe the Senate's culture and modus operandi from within. He did not like what he saw. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican Nebraska, accused Republicans and Democrats of being distracted from the big issues facing the United States by partisan bickering and soundbite news cycles. And here he says, the people despise us all. Why is this? Now, is Sasse, is he telling the truth right now? And is he legitimately bewildered? Does he think the Senate is doing a good job, and yet they are being despised, and nobody seems to understand why? Or is this evidence of something like the events we're seeing in South America, where all of a sudden people are saying, uh-oh. I don't know, we're gonna get rid of the leftists or the corrupt or whatever, and we're gonna bring in something that is right wing. Mm. Do you get that?
Right. Yes. Whether this is just a changing of deck,
leap in the breeze, or is it evidence of something serious taking place?
Well, there is something serious taking place. Whether Sasse is clued into that or not, I don't know. But I haven't seen the speech in question. But certainly there is a kind of groundwell of a sea change that's taking place. And I think that's been in the air for the last couple of election cycles. I think that's one of the reasons why Ron Paul's campaign was as successful as it was, is because the time is ripe for an alternative voice, something quite outside the mainstream. And that is being tapped into by Trump quite brilliantly, I think, in terms of PR strategy at any rate, if nothing else.
Do you think he's smart, or did he just get lucky and just catch the wave?
I think at this point it is obviously a PR strategy that he's using, and it's an exceptionally effective one to create controversy and outrage, to even to say things that are outright fabrications, like the New Jersey people celebrating 9/11 kind of thing, just things that are completely off the wall, but keep him in the news cycle. And I think it's working brilliantly so far. I think that ultimately will come back and bite him. I don't think that's the kind of thing that can be sustained through an entire campaign. I think by the time the primaries roll around and people are making their decisions, it will be very different. But at this point, it's a brilliant PR campaign, and it's working exactly to order, I think.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program tonight. I look forward to talking to you again next Thursday. We got to go, folks. We're way out of time. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Alfred Adisk, and between now and next time you listen, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank the producer, and James. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.